You're listening to the C-Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Well, this is the first ever C-Realm Book Club episode. We're talking about Frank Herbert's 1965 novel, Dune. And to get the conversation started, I have on the line from Santa Barbara, California, Dr. Keith Witt. He's an author, a psychotherapist, and he has a YouTube video channel called Therapist in the Wild. Dr. Witt, welcome to the C-Realm Podcast.
Glad to be here.
So we are assembled here, just the two of us now, but other voices will be joining us later, to talk about Dune, the novel, mm-hmm. definitely not the movie, definitely not the sci-fi TV series, and certainly not, although we could probably touch on it, the abandoned Jodorowsky version of the film, which I used to think that sounded so cool. I'm sorry it never got made. And now, the more I read about it and the more I listen to Jodorowsky talk about his vision, I'm glad it fell through. But the novel, I heard you recently speaking with Jeff Salzman, I think. And yes. You were talking about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey or the hero of a thousand faces. And you brought up Dune as an example of what?
Well, it's an example of quite a lot. But in terms of Campbell, Dune is a classic hero journey transition for Paul Atreides. He was called by his blood and by his family and by the worlds around him to serve. And like all heroes, he resisted it at first and then surrendered to the service and went through all the stages that a hero goes through in the hero's journey. He had to go to the threshold and do battle with the threshold guardians that were stopping him from his road of adventures. He had to go on the road of adventures, and there he had to experience the dark night of the soul, the belly of the whale. He had to reconcile with the feminine and with the masculine, deep injuries around his parents, and he was transformed as he received magical aid from the other world, and then became a master of two worlds. He was actually referred to in the book as the man who can be in many places at once, and then was drawn back, called back, crossed the threshold to serve his universe. It was a classic world server epic journey. Now, Frank Herbert was making a lot of other religious and socio-political points with that book, but the arc of Paul was the hero, the classic arc of the hero.
I just reread the book for the first time since I first read it in 1984, and I was really astounded by the pacing of the book. It leaps into action from page one. I mean, Paul wakes up in bed. His mom says, come into the next room. You have a test. And he has a test of the Gom Jabbar and the hand in the box. It feels like it's burning off. And the person administering that test is a reverend mother in the order of the Bene Gesserit. Would you consider her a threshold guardian of sorts?
Yes. And also, strangely, she was a source of magical aid, even though in the end he killed her in the second book. In that often the guardians are the demons. The paradox of the dark and the shadow appear often in the mythological architecture. And it appears an awful lot in Dune. It's one of the brilliance of that book, to a certain extent, is Herbert was able to capture the dark and the light, and for raised from bed and have to stick his hand in a box and have the subjective experience of having it burned off, changed him. He had been prepared since birth for trials of this sort, but he didn't know he was prepared. And this is, of course, reflective of the human experience. We prepare our children for the trials and passages, but their brains aren't fully mature enough to know what we're doing until they're in their teens, actually until they're about 15, which is how old he was when this happened.
Let's talk a little bit about the masculine and the feminine in Dune. In reading it, I could see how some doctrinaire feminists could be rather irritated with it and think it's pretty demeaning to women, although at a deeper, at least from my perspective, a deeper reading would be rather the reverse. And I wonder what you see in it.
Well, feminism has grown through stages since its birth, so to speak, in the 60s. And, I'm 63 years old. I was there when feminism started kicking ass. And we really now have postmodern integral feminism. And in postmodern integral feminism, the women in the book are viewed as powerful figures with equal power within the cultural context that that book takes place in. You know, Frank Herbert created a universe that really had very little rationality in it. It had power gods who controlled everybody by force. It had fundamentalist true believers. And then it had a few people that were egalitarian, not much. And rationality was profoundly suspicious to everybody. And in power god worldviews and in fundamentalist worldviews, there's inevitably the indirect power of the feminine. I mean, that's, you know, why essentially women were property for 10,000 years. Why we were in agrarian societies that were essentially conformist and fundamentalist or power god universes. And in those universes, that's what happens in the relationships between men and women. So women get power indirectly. And so, you know, an integral post-feminist would say, okay, you're in a fundamentalist environment, that means the feminine power has to come from certain directions. And, you know, Herbert really pulled a fast one on the way that cultural development really takes place, because in fundamentalism is essentially based on the divine right of kings. And so one of the ways that fundamentalism goes into rationality is everybody realizes that kings don't really have divine powers. Well, in the Dune universe, Paul Atreides had divine powers. He was a messenger of God, and he wasn't fucking around. He was the real thing. And what would happen in a universe where the messengers of God were walking around, you know, and were the real thing? And that was part of what Herbert was exploring with Paul. And that was part of the tragedy of Paul's life personally. One of his gifts was to be able to see multiple futures. And he discovered early on in his transformation into a world leader, and for him, universe-centric, not just world-centric, he discovered that he was trapped by his fate, that if he didn't go forward and become a fundamentalist messiah, that the universe would literally dissolve into chaos in his name, that jihad would rage and would be violent and would be horrible, and it would be uncontrolled. And that he was forced by the universe around him to take up the mantle of Messiah and to essentially conquer the known universe at the time, which he didn't want to do at all. It was just better than the alternative of utter chaos.
So I would ask that we confine the discussion to the first novel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, this was in the first novel, but it was just broad hints.
Yeah.
And he ended the first novel in an upbeat note. Remember, the last part of the first novel was Jessica talking to his wife, you know, talking to his wife. What did he call her? He said, my desert spring was the way he referred to his wife. And he wasn't
his wife, though. I mean, they're pretty clear about that. Chaney was to follow Jessica in the role basically of concubine, leaving Paul free to have a political marriage.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happens in fundamentalist cultures. Also, this was based hugely on Muslim culture. And just like in Muslim culture, you can have several wives. Paul had Chani, who was his concubine. He had Hana, who was a wife that he never had sex with. And then he had his official wife, who was the daughter of the emperor, who was his vehicle into becoming the emperor himself. So it was very much patterned. He was patterned a lot, really, off of the Muslim archetypes. And there's no coincidence that Herbert used Arabic names, Arabic icons, when he was doing Dune outfits, all that kind of stuff. And that Paul very much was Muhammad. Awful lot of aspects of Muhammad's life track Paul's experience. And, you know, Muhammad is the only messenger, really, major messenger, that was a warrior. And Paul was a major messenger who was a warrior. And, yeah, it definitely was a sexist society, no doubt about it. You know, any time that you have a culture where the rule of the power of the arm, you know, the warrior, is the foundation power, you're going to have men dominating women, which I said is human history until, what, 17th century, until the Enlightenment, until the Industrial Revolution, essentially.
With the Fremen, would you say that the Fremen were more egalitarian than the Universal Society, or less so?
No, they were more of a cult. You know, they basically were arranged in a fierce mythic membership, where basically everybody on the inside was human and everybody on the outside was fair game. And they had their mythological, their sacred texts, which were their traditions, which actually were stories and myths that had been seeded into their planet by the Bene Gesserit. Paul happened to be the Messiah that their myths had been predicting for hundreds of years. And they were essentially a fascist society, you know, waiting for a power god to take over. And, you know, Paul shows up, and in spite of himself, all of a sudden he's in charge of these maniac fanatics. Now, what do I do with them? Says Paul to himself. Now, you know, first of all, he gets revenge, and, you know, he takes the world back, and he does all the things that we would do to people who horribly massacred our family and everybody we knew and loved, and put an oppressive fascist state over our world. He took over and he created a forced egalitarianism, but it was forced. You know, after the Fremen took over everything, Paul arranged for everybody to have equal care and equal rights, but only because he ordered it. He knew, and he mentioned this in Dune, that if he disappeared, that's not the way it would have gone. It would have been the Fremen on the inside oppressing everybody else on the outside. And so, yeah, it was more of a mythic membership, fundamentalist society. You know, think the Taliban with the bomb. Okay, that's the Fremen.
Right.
The Taliban with the bomb, and they have Muhammad, the real thing, a messenger of God, in charge. Uh-oh. That's not good. So that's what happened in that world.
You describe Paul as having godlike powers. He can see into not the future, but many possible futures.
Yes.
And he can see what leads to each of them. And jihad in his name looms large in many, many futures, as does his death.
Yes.
But he's not the only one who can see the future.
That's right.
The guild navigators can also see the future, but Paul has an advantage over them in that he seems to realize and is able to act on this realization that prescience is a trap, particularly when you're just navigating for short-term gain.
Yes. And part of that insight came from the fact that, you know, the Bene Gesserit, their gift was that they could remember all their past lives. Anybody that they were genetically, the Reverend Mothers, anybody that they were genetically connected with historically, they had actual memories of those lives. And there'd never, ever been a man in that universe that had had that gift, other than the, you know, kind of the demon artificers, Talaxels. But that's another book. So they had the past, the Bene Gesserit. The guild people could see into the future, and that's how they navigated their ships. Paul had both of those gifts. Excuse me. He could see into all possible futures. Also, he could access all his past lives. And he'd been raised in a household that had world-centric service as the organizing principle. His mother and father raised him to have an understanding, a worldview that we're here to serve each other and to serve the highest good. So that ethical system, meeting those skills, created a new force in that galaxy, in that universe, because that didn't exist. He was the only person that had all those things coming together. He had the world-centric ethics, you know, the moral imperative to serve. He had access to all his previous genetic connections, and he could see multiple futures. And so he felt a profound responsibility to serve humanity. And that was his primary identification. He was human-centric. He loved everybody.
I read the book, or reread it, at the insistence of a friend who said it's more relevant now than ever.
Yes.
And Paul is somebody who was raised with a certain cultural set of sensibilities. He was a noble person. I mean, not just noble birth, but also raised to be a person who exemplifies nobility. And he is, as you say, placed in charge of a pack of fanatical cultists who he really has to manage carefully to prevent them from running roughshod over the universe.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, Frank Herbert could not possibly have been trying to encode any messages about the U.S. occupation of Iraq or the U.S. adventures in Afghanistan at the time. But it seems very much, it really seems relevant now in that context, in that the U.S., we've invaded Afghanistan, and like so many other empires before us, found that it's a real mess and it's no picnic. And I heard on the radio a few years ago a debate between military planners who were saying, look, we have no ongoing strategic interest here. There are no resources here for us to, you know, to be fighting over. There's nothing here that should have us continuing to pour blood and treasure into this sinkhole. And then there were, I'm having trouble describing them without sounding prejudicial, but people giving a feminist presentation of, look, the people of Afghanistan are oppressed by their own culture and we can't just leave them to their fate. And yet we don't really have the ability to drop all of our sensibilities on them as a culture and say, okay, we're not leaving until women enjoy total equality, girls can go to school, and basically you exemplify the values of somebody who's living in Santa Barbara, California. I mean, if that's the bar for exit, then we'll never leave.
Uh-huh. But, well, first of all, I think Herbert was subtly commenting on Vietnam, because Vietnam was the Iraq and Afghanistan of the 60s. It was even worse than Iraq and Afghanistan, because the United States basically had children soldiers with the draft. They did the same thing with the young people in the 60s that the African warlords are doing with 12-year-olds now. They took 18-year-olds and forced them to go kill people, forced them to learn killing skills, forced them to go kill people, and punished them if they didn't. And, you know, you had to have lived there to feel the level of outrage, the wrongness, the moral wrongness of that activity. And so there's an undercurrent, a fierce undercurrent in Herbert's book against fascism of all sorts. You can just feel, you know, his opposition to fascism. And to speak specifically to what you're talking about with Afghanistan, from an integral perspective, you can look at what these people are saying, and you can see the validity of all their sides. One thing that is absolutely sure, you know, this is comes from, in integral, we look at facts as well as biases. Okay. So the facts are pretty incontrovertible when it comes to cultural change. If you want to change the culture of a country, the worst way to do it is to invade it. Absolute fucking worst possible way. But fundamentalists, and Bush and Cheney, are, of course, were fundamentalists themselves. I mean, Bush idiotically used the word crusade when he went over into Iraq, not thinking that 200 years of Middle East history was dominated by Westerners waging crusades in the Middle East. And foolishly, because he had Cheney had a belief that everybody would say, sure, we're going to skip from basically fascist dictatorships into rationality. You don't skip levels. And so, you know, once we got embroiled in that, we became fascist dictators. You know, as far as everybody was concerned, it didn't matter how benevolent America has felt. You know, you're basically in an environment where if you don't dominate people physically, they're going to blow you up. It's just a total mess. And so in most Americans don't realize that most Afghanistan people don't even read. They're illiterate. And so if we wanted to change Afghanistan, there's a lot of things we could have done that would have had great effects and that would have spoken to those worldviews. Great example, the whole thing about the Taliban training terrorists to come to the United States. Okay, well, you know, find out wherever the first wave into Afghanistan just basically knocked out all the terrorist training camps, and then we developed drone technology. All right, Fascists actually do need their asses kicked. Okay, so we have a drone technology. Anytime somebody's training terrorists, go blow them up. All right. I mean, I don't particularly think that's the best solution, but I can't think of a better one. But then what do you do? Well, first of all, what you do with Afghanistan is you legalize drugs. Because what's their main cash crop? Heroin. And so, you know, that's been operating below the surface with gangster gangs, essentially in Afghanistan for the last 50 years. So you legalize heroin. You go, okay, you guys want to be a major heroin exporter? Fine. You know, export heroin and, you know, we'll regulate it and, you know, we'll buy it and, you know, we'll develop supply chains so that you can have your heroin and all that other stuff. And, oh, we need educated people and we need computers to track. You know, you can see what you do is you bring modernity into the country wherever the hell, but modernity can be absorbed into the country. If you start giving people computers and stuff, they naturally start educating women. Now, in the process, that's a slow process. Women would still be oppressed. Horrible things would be happening. But, you know, horrible things are happening in Saudi Arabia. Women are being oppressed. And we're not invading Saudi Arabia. Horrible things are happening in lots of countries. Practically every fundamentalist country and every power god country in this world is oppressing women and children as we speak. And so, you know, why did we choose Afghanistan and Iraq to go invade? Well, you know, because we had our own fundamentalist mythic beliefs that weren't being cross-validated with rationality. You know, it's funny. You look back over history. You know, if Clinton hadn't had blowjobs, then maybe he would have campaigned for Gore. Maybe Gore would have won, and maybe. You know, in a way, that's what Paul Madib was doing. He was seeing all the possible realities. And those of us in the 90s, and you're probably around thinking about that, when everybody was all casual about the election between Gore and Bush, a lot of us were tearing our hair out because we were seeing possible futures. You know, Bush was running against peace, prosperity, and a $1 trillion surplus on a balanced budget. Everybody felt all fat and happy and felt, oh, we can do something different because, oh, we're tired of Bill Clinton. Well, unfortunately, everybody was wrong. The futures that he brought are still staggering the world and causing problems and will for generations to come now. We have a generation of men and women that have been traumatized by these wars in the United States. And those two countries have been completely disrupted and still are erupting into anarchy. We slowed down development in those countries by 50 or 60 years and added millions of people that are going to be suffering the wounds, the psychological and physical wounds of that war for 50 years. It's going to cost us trillions of dollars. It's just appalling. And a lot more women are going to be oppressed because of it. And that, why is that? Because the people who waged war in Afghanistan, the Bush-Cheney people, they didn't care about rationality. They didn't ask social scientists about what the possible consequences were. They didn't really take their military seriously about what the hell things were going on. They had their own fundamentalist beliefs and they merrily went on their way. Very much like the Taliban has their fundamentalist beliefs. Ironically, the Bush administration, the Taliban had the same psychology. One of the most ironic things I ever saw. Anyway. And so, yeah, going back to your point, no, we can't have that standard of, okay, we're going to hold a gun to everybody's head until they educate women. All we have to do is just find ways of taking modernity and channeling it into the world. The internet is already doing that. The millennials are a generation, the first huge generation of adults. This is KMO. This is one of the most staggering effects of the modern world that nobody seems to comment on. The millennials identify more with each other than they do with the countries that they live in. For the first time in the world, we have huge numbers of young people, powerful people, people who are going to be in charge, who identify more with a world-centric consciousness than with an ethnocentric consciousness. This is heralding in the integral age. And this is another reason why Dune speaks to today. Dune was on the cusp of a major transformation in that universe. We are on the cusp of a major transformation on the planet Earth. We are shifting from ethnocentric to world-centric. There is going to be an integral awakening in the next 20 years. Everything's going to be different. And all of us can matter, just like Paul mattered, just like his friends mattered. They all knew that since they were in the cusp of history, what they did was going to have huge impacts. What Jessica did, Paul's mother, huge impacts. What Shani did, they could feel the mythic significance of who they were and where they were. And that's true for a lot of us now. Almost all the teachers, you talk to them, they go, wow, You know, we're at a cusp of history. A little bit can have a huge effect, just like in chaotic systems. A little, if you look at fractals, chaotic systems, sometimes a little push from one direction can have a huge impact. We're living in an age like that right now. And that was the age that Paul was in Dune. Paul was the spark that brought in a new age in that universe. And we all want to be, us, all of us, all as teachers, we want to be a spark that heralds in a new age on Earth.
Hopefully without jihad.
Well, you know, every fundamentalist system, say Christians. Okay, the Christian system advocates jihad. You know, missionary work is jihad by another name. You just don't hold a gun. You know, you just don't force people by violence these days as a Christian to be a Christian. But you definitely, every Christians think it's fine to go into some country and try to turn people from, I don't know, Islam into Christians or Buddhism into Christians or whatever into Christians. So, yes. You know, as long as we don't have a fundamentalist belief, and, you know, basically Bush and Cheney had a fundamentalist belief in democracy. They really weren't advocating. Neither one of them understood democracy. To this day, neither one of them understands democracy. You know, they basically had a fundamentalist belief about the superiority of the American system. And they were unconsciously wanting to go colonize the world. You know, they were colonialists. And so I agree with you that, you know, modernity had, this is why I love the millennials identifying with each other rather than with their ethnocentric countries. It's not about one country dominating another. Everybody understands everything's connected both culturally and economically, and we want everybody to do well. And more and more and more, that's the standard. That was a radical concept in the 60s. If you had that concept in the 60s, you were oppressed. You know, one of the reasons we were all hippies in the 60s is because, you know, we were oppressed anyway for our beliefs. We might as well band together. You know, and since we weren't all black or brown, we all wore weird clothes and let our hair grow so we could know each other.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
Well, we've spoken of prescient visions. We've spoken of drugs in the form of opium and heroin. I think that leads us into the topic of the spice.
Well, yes, the spice.
Which Frank Herbert described as a geriatric drug, but also, oh, I forget his exact terminology, but something to the effect of an awareness spectrum narcotic.
Yeah.
And it was the spice, actually, that combined with Paul's training from Jessica in the Bene Gesserit ways, also his early childhood training to be a mentat, that all combined with the careful husbanding of his genetic lineage by the Bene Gesserit, all that came together when he moved to Arrakis and he was suddenly getting huge doses of spice just in everything, in his food, you know, just breathing it in the air. And that woke him up. And I just finished the book and there's a new appendix in it. It's sort of a postscript by Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son.
Yes.
Yeah. And in it, Brian Herbert says that Frank Herbert had one experience with psilocybin mushrooms, and he implies that that Frank was dosed, that he didn't do it voluntarily, basically trying to protect his father's image. But
that's total bullshit.
Yeah, I read Mycelium Running by Paul Stamets, and in it, Paul Stamets talks about having been friends with Frank Herbert and how Frank Herbert described to him how the magic mushroom, the magic spice that allowed the bending of space, that this was totally... it was inspired. It was a reference to the psilocybin mushrooms, and that Maria Sabina, the curandera who introduced Gordon Wasson to the mushroom ritual, was very much an archetype from which he drew to flesh out the Bene Gesserit characters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the idea that he got dosed once against his will is silly.
Well, yes, and remember, you know, the 60s, we were all taking acid and psilocybin and having these kinds of experiences. And, you know, anybody who'd taken acid or taken mushrooms recognized the imagery and the experiences. You know, when Paul was describing those experiences, those are exactly the experiences you have when you take a lot of acid or you take a lot of mushrooms. I remember taking mushrooms once, walking into a theater and seeing a large tunnel of demons. It was one of the most vivid hallucinations I've ever seen in my life. And there was a lot of belief at the time that you could do spiritual bypassing in a particular kind of way, that somehow there was a right drug that could dramatically accelerate the development of consciousness. You know, that had yet to be disproved by developmentalists. And so we were all looking for that. And I think Frank Herbert kind of took it to the next level. And remember, the interesting thing about that is Frank Herbert played a lot with addiction in his books. You know, the Harkonnen's guard was addicted to Samuda, which was a drug where you took this drug and you listened to music, and it was addictive, very much like marijuana. You know, a lot of people in those days were smoking marijuana and listening to music, and, you know, that was their drug of choice. And the acid itself, As it turns out, psychedelics aren't physically addictive, as far as I can tell from the literature and from my own personal experience. But yeah, it was based on that. And after a while, what happened with Paul is the drugs literally were a gateway. You know, what they did is they opened up fields of consciousness for him, and he didn't need the drugs after all. You know, there was a while he was drinking the spice liquor to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And then there was a further transformation in Paul where he didn't need the spice liquor anymore. He was just always there. He was always in the other world and this world at the same time, which is exactly what happens if you do decades of contemplative work. You reach a point where you feel like you're stable in this world and in the other world. And, you know, people who are the transmitters in this planet, you can feel them channeling something from someplace else. You know, most of us, when we're in our area where we have special wisdom, there's a feeling that something is coming through us. And if you're listening to somebody doing that, you know, you're feeling that there's something else besides, you know, like, am I talking, there's something besides Keith coming through to you. You know why? Well, you know, there's this particular area where I have a channel. You know, Paul had a really, you know, he had a channel as big as the Mississippi. And it really had profound cultural impacts. But, you know, a lot of us have that. Now, you and I are talking. We can look over the next 10 years and we can see what's going to happen if profound changes aren't made. Okay, but so we have that sight. What do we do with it? You know, we can see that the planet is going to have predictable catastrophes, just like Gore did with Inconvenient Truth. But what do we do with it? We can see that war is a ridiculous response to anything other than protecting people from genocide, which is what Clinton did in Bosnia. But what can we do with that insight? You know, we can see that there are technological solutions to all the world's problems. We can see the solutions. You know, the solution, for instance, to overpopulation has been around for a long time. Educate women. Educated women have smaller families. We can see the solutions. But what do we do with them? You know, Paul was in a position of seeing the solutions and kind of constrained by his culture, kind of as we're constrained. It has huge parallels with modern society, in my opinion.
I'm in New York City. Ah. And in 2011, in the fall of 2011, Occupy Wall Street burst onto the scene. Mm-hmm. And I remember I went to this enormous rally down in Times Square, and somebody was holding up a sign. This was the greatest thing. It had two coiled sandworms, coiled sort of referencing the Don't Tread on Me flag.
Yeah.
But the slogan with the two sandworms was, "The spice must flow." So spice is a drug, but it's also a bit of an analog to oil when it comes to looking at Dune from a sociopolitical perspective.
Isn't that interesting? And, you know, Herbert probably had that on his mind, too. Not to mention the fact that it was coming from a desert planet, like all our oil was coming from Saudi Arabia in the 60s. And the Bush family in those days were really – Joe Bush was really tight with Saudi Arabia. They have connections that go back, you know, to the 50s. Absolutely. It was a total metaphor.
So I can imagine the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen asking, why did God put our spice under their desert?
Yes. He was a great bad guy, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. One of the all-time great villains in science fiction history, an operatic villain, larger than life in every way imaginable villain.
Yes.
Total red power god, self-indulgent red power god. Totally power for its own sake. Totally malice for its own sake. Much worse than Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, who were pretty nasty themselves. You know, that was the Baron Harkonnen. He was a perfect foil for Paul. Because Paul basically was put in a position, you know, we're going to have an emperor in this culture. So is it going to be him or is it going to be you? And Paul went, okay, since those are my choices, I'll have to choose me. Because I'm an honorable, virtuous man. Paul was basically the philosopher king that Plato talked about in the Republic. Plato had no faith in the collective because he realized even then, 400 BC, that probably 80 or 90% of the people on the planet were ethnocentric or egocentric in their worldviews. And that what you needed is somebody who had a broad vision in charge of everybody, the philosopher king. That was Plato's sense. And to a certain extent, Paul recapitulated that in Dune. Okay, if somebody's got to be in charge, I guess it better be me because I care about everybody and nobody else around here cares about everybody. Everybody else around here just cares about themselves. You know, I read Dune in, I don't know, when it first came out. And then for the rest of my life, for the next 15 or 20 years, every time I was going through some kind of horrible bad time, I would read Dune and I would read the Tolkien trilogy because I read the Tolkien trilogy in 1962 when it wasn't even available in the United States. I sent away to England for it. And Dune was one of my sacred texts. I knew intuitively as a teenager that there was wisdom in this book that would keep, you know, teaching me for the rest of my life, and it has.
I reread the book just recently, and there's a character that I had completely forgotten from my first reading, and I think he's pretty downplayed in the film versions as well. And that is the Count Hasimir Fenring.
Oh, yes.
Who apparently is the source of Paul's death in so many of the visions that Paul has, you know, so many paths into the future where he's just a corpse. He dies at Count Fenring's hand, but he's such a minor presence in the book. And yet the emperor looks to him after Paul has killed Fade and says, okay, it's your turn. And there's no doubt in anybody's mind, really, that the Count Fenring would emerge victorious in that fight, and yet he declines.
Exactly.
What's that all about?
Well, first of all, remember, this was a divine right of king, monarchy. The empire was literally based on the divine rights of kings. In every, an awful lot of the courts, there was the jester. The jester was not just some Groucho Marx fool. And, you know, Groucho Marx was the jester. He was somebody that could speak truth in ways that other people couldn't without getting their ass kicked or their head cut off. He had special powers. Actually, he was Coyote, the trickster. Very much like the archetype that many of us therapists identify with. He was the one that could speak truth to power in a power god environment or in a fascist environment and not be oppressed. Why? Because he himself could be many places at once. He was an integral guy. He could see the light and the dark of many points of view. And so he was this integral guy that was put in there, who was, you know, the advisor to the king, to the emperor, doing his best to make the empire a better place. And also, like many of those guys, you know, I'm a martial artist. You know, people who have that consciousness, who can see the light and dark of many worldviews, tend to study martial arts when they're kids. And there's a reason for that. One, they really like the archetype of the warrior, which leads to the archetype of the man of wisdom. And two, they can feel how dangerous everybody's worldview is. They know that everybody has a potential for violence in the dark side, and they feel kind of nervous, particularly if they're a guy, and so they kind of want to have special skills, and they study martial arts. It's one of the reasons I studied martial arts for 15 years, not the main reason after a while. So anyway, here he is. But unlike anybody else around there, he has a world-centric view. He has a human-centric view of the universe. He wants to serve the highest good. That's why his wife is a Bene Gesserit, and she betrayed her Bene Gesserit vows to tell him everything. You know, he knew all the Bene Gesserit secrets that you weren't supposed to know, but his wife told him she could tell he was one of those extraordinary people. His worldview, his philosophy was more aligned with Paul's than anybody else in that universe. He saw Paul as a brother. He saw Paul as the hope of a peaceful universe after that. He saw him as somebody that could do it better than the emperor. And so he made his choice. And significantly, the emperor didn't kill him. Pissed off. You know, pissed off emperors tend to kill people. Didn't kill Fenring, which I found fascinating. You know, he valued him so much, he went, well, you fucked me over, but, you know, I'm going to keep you around. Why? You're just that important. He was the integral wise man in that book. And it's interesting that you pointed him out, because he occupies a place all of his own. In future books, he's commented upon. And the Bene Gesserit said, yeah, he himself was sterile. Could have been Quetzalcoatl Haderach himself. He could have been a man who could be in many places at once himself if he had drunk the spice liquor and so on. But his psychology was not to have power over other people. You know, very much like a therapist. Therapists hate having power over other people. We like guiding people to find their own power. We have antibodies around being in charge of, you know, being, you know, that, those kinds of leaders. So it's interesting to mention him. I identified in a way more with him than pretty much with anybody else in the book. As I matured and became more and more of a therapist.
I think when I first read the book in 1984, I declined to read the appendices, which was a mistake. I was gravitated to the figure of Liet Kynes in the book, and it wasn't until when I just reread the book just recently that I read the appendix, which was basically the account of his father, Pardot Kynes, and their long, long vision for the transformation of the planet Arrakis.
He had a wonderful lineage. And interesting, he went from rationality. Remember, in this culture, this universe, had antibodies to rationality. So, you know, the Kynes to his father was the purest scientist that we find in this book. And Kynes himself basically regressed. He regressed from scientist into a fundamentalist conformist. He realized to have the impact that he needed, he had to become a religious figure, and so he embraced it. And he did. He wasn't just pretending. He was experiencing himself as a religious figure, as a prophet to a certain extent. And he had his vision. that he got from his father.
He was certainly a master of two worlds.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was.
But
it was one of the geniuses of Herbert's book is that there are access points for anybody. If you're a scientist, Kynes was your access point into that world. We can go, yeah, I can see how a person based in rationality, based in empiricism, could make it over to the other side. And now all of a sudden, they're now in mysticism. In a way, Kynes anticipated the integral revolution of today. Because the thing that I love about integral, and one of the reasons that I teach it, is that integral has one foot in pure spirituality, one foot in pure empiricism. And there's a comprehensive structure, scaffolding that moves all through integral that completely combines and integrates and makes all those different perspectives coherent. And that's what Kynes did. And Kynes recognized Paul as someone who could bring his dream to life. You know, he had his commitment to Arrakis. And so he surrendered his life to him, essentially, and his daughter. You know, I can't do any more than that.
Well, as much as I hate to say it, that's probably about as much time as we can devote to Dune in this conversation. But okay. Dr. Keith Witt, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and your deep familiarity with this book.
Sure. It was wonderful talking with you about it, Kim. Well, have a wonderful book club.
You're listening to the Signal Podcast.
Your mind, 1 week at a time.